Welcome back, movie fans. It's been our distinct pleasure on this season of Movie Mindset to take some time to talk to the people who really matter, the people who make movies. And I'm just going to jump right into it because we are thrilled today to be able to talk to a filmmaker whose work I have adored for years. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to our program the director of Repo Man, Alex Cox. Alex, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. And I'm sorry that it was all kind of a bit alarming a few minutes ago. But I'm a member of a volunteer fire department in rural Oregon, and we're about half an hour from town. And so if we get an emergency and it's not, you know, broken back or something like that, it's quicker to take the customer to the emergency room than to wait for the ambulance to arrive. And they save $2,000 in the process.
Yeah.
I failed to mention to my co-host here that you had said that you had to take somebody to the hospital this morning. I did not want to alarm them as we were figuring out if you were going to make this or not.
It was a lady who thought she was having a heart attack, and she actually wasn't. But it was necessary for me to wait outside the emergency room for 5 hours. But here I am back just in time.
Yes.
Well, I thank you for your service to both that lady and to the people of Oregon. But I'd like to talk about the people of the city of Los Angeles. Alex, we just finished watching Repo Man. It was the last movie that we did on this series of Movie Mindset. I've seen it like probably at least a half dozen times over the course of my life. But in rewatching it this time, something that really struck me was just how perfectly it captures both America and Los Angeles, like a really like just essential sense of time and space. And I was wondering if you could talk about your experience of moving to LA from the UK to go to UCLA and how your sort of impressions of America and Los Angeles as sort of a semi-outsider, like how, like what were they and like how they contributed to like what we see on the screen in Repo Man?
Well, I mean, everybody in the world pretty much has an impression of America or of the United States because of all the media that we see. So everybody has an idea of America, you know, or the US. What I didn't realize was that LA was any different from anywhere else. I mean, I just assumed all American cities were like that, you know, because it was the only one that I knew. And I had been living in Los Angeles, I guess, for like 6 years before we made Repo Man. So I'd become very familiar with L.A. But as far as I knew, everywhere was like that.
I mean, it's like when watching it, you really feel like this is the real L.A. This is the L.A. that you see when you walk down the street in L.A. If you're one of the few people who actually does that, and like the L.A. that exists outside the blur of traffic. But just like your sense of like Los Angeles and how perfectly you captured it on film, like what is it about LA that that made it into the movie?
Well, that's what it was like in those days. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that what you said on your show about Repo Man, which I enjoyed listening to, was that a lot of these, like what was once a junkyard is now artists' condos, you know, and especially the downtown area that we were shooting in, and the city of Vernon, the city of industry. In those days, nobody would voluntarily live there because the air quality was so poor. But then things changed, you know, unleaded gas came in and there was more public transport. And the air quality in Los Angeles got better for a while. And so then people started thinking, oh, I actually can move and live in the city of Vernon, you know, which I think nobody would have voluntarily done in the 1980s.
You know, I said on the episode that like when I first saw Repo Man, it was like, you know, opening the Stargate in my mind. I was like, I didn't know that they could make movies like that that seemed so specifically for me. And I think a big part of it was that it was the first movie I ever saw with Harry Dean Stanton. And Chris mentioned, I think it was from one of your commentaries, you said there was a run of movies in the 60s and 70s in America that were actually really good. And they all had Harry Dean Stanton in them. I'm just wondering, like, do you remember the first movie you saw with Harry Dean Stanton? And what about him makes him such a compelling leading man?
I think the first film that I saw him where I learned his name was The Missouri Breaks, a Western with Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson. And Harry Dean was a member of the gang in that film. And there's this early on in the movie, he's getting a haircut, and literally they have put a pudding basin on his head and they're cutting around the pudding basin. And I thought, you know, this guy is a serious actor. He's not messing around. You know, many actors are vain and they wouldn't want a pudding basin haircut, you know, but Harry went for it. And although I have to warn you too, I mean, I think somebody said in the show that Harry Dean would be the ideal father. No, you do not want Harry Dean for your father. You would be terminally, terminally messed up if Harry Dean.
I have a question that kind of relates to what you said about how he's a serious actor and most actors nowadays would be too vain to get a pudding basin haircut. It's something I notice in a lot of your movies is that you're not afraid to let the characters get silly with it and to let them, you know, be... may look like a fool on camera. Is that something you dislike about modern movies? Is this vanity and refusal to look bad on film?
Yeah, I don't think that's quite the same as looking like a fool, though. I think that today, if you're the actor prepares today by going to the gym and checking their Instagram, you know, seeing how many followers they have. And back in the day, I don't even know what those actors did to prepare, but it was something different.
But Harry drinking was a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, drink a bottle of whiskey. I mean, Harry was, as he said frequently, a complicated character. And at the beginning of the shoot, he told me that he wasn't going to learn his lines. He was going to have them written on cards and have them taped to the dashboard and read them. And I said, no, you can't do that. You have to learn your lines. And he said, listen, Warren Oates did that. If Warren Oates did that, I can do it. And I mean, Warren Oates was the greatest American actor of all time. So in a way, Harry had a point. But I tricked him because I told him that if he wouldn't learn his lines, he would be violating his Screen Actors Guild oath. And he believed me, you know. There is no Screen Actors Guild oath, you know. But I told him that as a member of the Screen Actors Guild, he was sworn to come to the set every day having learned his lines. And he did, you know. So he could do it. It's just I think at the outset, he didn't think very much of the film. You know, he didn't think the film was very good or would amount to very much. He didn't like the script very much. It was just a payday for him. And then over the years, he realized that the film or the people liked the film, you know, and that it had been a good idea to be in it. And also it got him the job in Paris, Texas, because Wim Wenders was going to go with Dean Stockwell for that role. And when Robbie Mueller came out to shoot Repo Man, he phoned Wim and said, hey, listen, there's an actor out here that you might want to consider for the lead role in Paris, Texas, which they were going to do immediately after Repo Man. Mm-hmm. And his name is Harry Dean Stanton. And so sure enough, you know, I guess that Wim tracked him down on film and saw what he was like and signed him up. And so Dean Stockwell got relegated to the sort of the supporting role in that film. And Harry, of course, was, boy, I mean, Repo Man and Paris, Texas are probably his two greatest roles, and also maybe his only two starring role.
Yeah, it's only two. I was going to say he's usually like in a supporting role. I'd like to talk about another actor in Repo Man. As I sort of audition, you know, I'll try out various father figures. Maybe you set me right with this one. But an actor who's something of a good luck charm for you, he shows up a lot of times in your movies, is Miguel Sandoval, who plays Archie in Repo Man. I'll always remember him from the first scene of Jurassic Park and playing the Pablo Escobar character in Clear and Present Danger. How did you and Miguel link up, and what has led to such a fruitful collaboration between you two?
We met through Michael Nesmith, who was the producer of a film called Time Rider, which they'd made in New Mexico. And Michael was the executive producer of Repo Man. And he introduced me to two actors, both of whom I think had been in Time Rider, who he thought would be good in Repo Man. One was Miguel, and the other was Tracy Walter.
Oh, wow.
You know, so Michael's instincts were very, very good.
And what led you to keep working with Miguel so often? Like, he's in Three Businessmen, he's in A Small Part in Sid and Nancy, he's like
Straight to Hell.
Straight to Hell, yeah.
Oh, I think if you meet good actors, you know, if you are fortunate enough to work with good actors, you should keep trying to work with them, because that was the idea of all the, you know, the directors that we looked up to when we were students, you know, whether it was Lindsay Anderson or Sam Peckinpah or John Ford, they all had, you know, a stock company. And so that was what we were. Or I don't know if we all were inclined towards that, but I certainly felt if you could meet a number of good actors, another one, of course, being Cy Richardson, then keep working with them, you know, because your relationship will develop and you'll form a sort of a shorthand where it's not necessary for you to tell them that much stuff, because you've already worked together and they already know what to do.
Just piggybacking on what you said about the people you looked up to, the people we all look up to in film school, I was wondering, something I really admire about your movies is that you have this ability to move between genres, but never really lose this essential Alex Coxness, even if you use different techniques like Straight to Hell, all the spaghetti Western like inserts, or the Highway Patrolman with all the, you know, handheld long like takes with no inserts at all. There's this like through line that runs through your work of, and I'm wondering,
what is it? What is that through line? Tell me.
I think it's just this beautiful like eye for, I mean, it's very stock and silly to say, but like this beautiful compositions, very graceful, like, they're all very beautiful movies, and they all, I don't know, they grab you and they move you a little bit.
That's interesting. I mean, I you're right about that, I think, because even though they are, the subject matter is generally not the most estimable, but the visual aspect is often incredibly beautiful. And I think that's because I've been fortunate enough to work with really good camera people like Robbie and Roger Deakins, David Bridges, Steve Fairberg, Miguel Garcon. You know, I've been very lucky in being able to work with such good cinematographers that I could just trust, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about, you know, I mentioned this a few times on the episode, listen to your commentary, and I loved you talking about the scene in Repo Man when he is walking along the LA River and screaming TV party. And as the camera pans over this beautiful sunrise shot, you're just going, wait for it, wait for it, wait for it, and point there. And then the light, one of the street lights comes on right as the shot cuts.
No, all the lights go out.
They go out. And I just really appreciated how, you know, proud you were of capturing that one perfect moment that, you know, has to come with his blocking and the singing and the lighting, and then something you can't really control, the street lights and everything. I think that speaks to what, you know, Hess is getting at, is like, even though this is a grimy moment of this punk on the dirty side of the river, just the eye for detail of getting this pop of light and the closing off of light in the background, it feels like a particularly Coxian visual moment.
And that was Los Angeles. That was the city of Los Angeles, because we actually turned the lights off ourselves. We had two guys from the downtown public utilities division, whatever it's called.
LADWP.
DWP. And one of them was really tall and skinny and looked like Ichabod Crane. The other one was like really short and fat, and his name was Mr. Knickerbocker.
I'm surprised you didn't get these people in the movie.
It was like out of a Raymond Chandler novel. And they said, you know, you just tell us when and we'll pull the switch, you know? And we did two takes and they pulled the switch. And that was really amazing. And now I guess it wouldn't be that way. They've been replaced by software.
You do it in post. Lord,
the king of filming at night. But Alex, if I could suggest like potentially another through line in your films, it's that a thing that shines through is your very strong political sensibility and like political point of view. And like a lot of movies shy away from having an unabashedly political point of view. And one of the things we mentioned on our episode is that you talk about how Repo Man is a portrait of a young punk who becomes a reactionary small businessman with more or less no change in their character. And I was thinking about this because I thought of another movie that came out in 1984 that is, you know, thematically, but, you know, if not spiritually linked to Repo Man. And that's Ivan Reitman's Ghostbusters, which is another movie about slackers who become reactionary small business owners. And I'm just wondering if, like, that 80s cultural turn in which, like, becoming totally cynical and out for yourself kind of became a form of rebellion, like, whether you see that sort of as a failure of previous cultural movements, be it like the hippies or the punk era, to achieve anything political.
I don't know. I'm just trying to get my head around what you said, because Ghostbusters is a viciously reactionary film.
Yeah, yes. No, I mean, like I said,
most Hollywood movies, it's completely reactionary. Who is the villain in Ghostbusters?
EPA.
It's the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the wet dream of the reactionaries who run Hollywood, you know?
Yeah.
That's why Ghostbusters is a $25 million film and Repo Man is a $1.1 million film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah. I guess what I think what Will's saying is, like, you know, do you see Repo Man as kind of skewering the thing that Ghostbusters is in celebrating?
Repo Man is the antithesis
yes.
of most of the films that Hollywood was making at that time and continues to make today. Immediately after he finished Repo Man, Emilio Estevez was hoping to get a part in Red Dawn.
Of course.
Right.
And,
yes.
And the producers and I
his brother
just skewered
got that
him.
One.
Yeah. You know, we said, if you're in Red Dawn, man, we're going to humiliate you in this film. You know, every chance we get, when you're off camera, there's going to be sniveling and weeping and, you know, and whining, you know. And we would have done it too. Especially in the scene with Cy Richardson where he's getting shot at and
Cy right.
says, you're still on the job, why get in the car? You know, no, he would have come over really, really lame. You know, like the fold pants guy. It would have been even more of that excuse me while I fold my pants stuff, you know. But fortunately, I think he auditioned for Red Dawn, but luckily he didn't get a part. And so, you know, we didn't have to do any of those horrible things. But this is how bad things are. This is how bad things are. The imbecile guy who was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, who's now the national security advisor to Joe Biden, Jake Sullivan, he gave an interview recently in which he says he grew up on these great movies like Red Dawn.
Oh, God.
And you realize, oh, my God, this is a really straight little son of a bitch who never saw Repo Man. If he did, he didn't. You know? And his idea of a great film is Red Dawn. And so then you think, well, this is why in the White House, and not just in the White House, but in other Western capitals, there's this, is the word Manichaean? I don't know how to pronounce it. This division into good and evil. And you're not permitted any gray area. You know, it's either, you know, Americans good, Russians bad, you know, like Red Dawn.
Yeah.
And that was interesting because it always seemed to me that even the most reactionary characters, like the Repo Men or the inventor of the neutron bomb, there was good in them. And even in the, you know, the most outrageous punky bad boys, you know, there was something really lame in them, you know. And so nobody is an archetype, and nobody is good, and nobody is evil. Well, there are evil people, but in general,
make an exception for Jake Sullivan,
Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken, Victoria Nuland, Biden and Trump and Pompeo. You know,
Alex,
there are
some
exceptions.
You're speaking my language here, but like in Repo Man, one of the things we talked about is that, like, in the background there are news reports which sort of contextualize the era of as one of, like, Reagan's dirty wars in Central America that was going on at the time. You know, Otto's parents are sending Bibles to El Salvador, and it's like you're sort of almost previewing Walker. If you want to talk about a movie that people in the White House should watch, is Walker, and a movie that Chris said, I just watched it, perfectly captures America and what we really are and what we stand for in this country. But I guess I'm wondering, like, when you, like, one of my favorite parts of your movies is how unabashedly left-wing they are. And, like, by the end of Walker, when we're seeing Coke cans and cars, or at the end of Revenger's Tragedy, where you just show the 9/11 footage, you couldn't be more obvious about
Troy's
power.
Oh, no, we had to cut that out. We were made to cut that out. Yeah. The 9/11 footage was in the rough cut, and the British Film Council, who were among the financiers, forbade us to use that footage because we would never get a distribution in America. The film didn't get a distribution.
Yeah, your adaptation of a Jacobean tragedy couldn't get distribution in America. Yeah, it was because of the 9/11 footage.
Yeah, because of 9/11 footage. But the thing is, it's the English are terribly afraid of the Americans. The English live in quaking fear of the Americans. And they always seek to appease whatever wicked crime the Americans embark upon. So, you know, invade Iraq, Tony Blair will be there, you know, destroy Libya, David Cameron will be there, you know, whatever happens next, you know, nuclear war with Russia, Keir Starmer, Sir Keir Starmer, he'll be there on the front lines, you know, well, actually, no, he'll be in his bunker, you know, in New Zealand.
The Starmer Fuhrer bunker. I can't wait.
It is interesting because the thing is, and I think in a way, by coming to America and living in Los Angeles and being, you know, not a wealthy person, being just a person that has to, you know, has to make money and survive in a relatively modest way, you know, you get a completely different view of things from what you do if you're a, you know, a public school boy in England who then becomes prime minister.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I guess my question was like, how do you like seek to express a real political point of view and a left-wing political point of view in your movies, like either through genre or however you wed it to your films? It's overt, but it's not, it never feels didactic or leaden, which often is the problem with, like, I don't know, incorporating political ideology or points of view into a film. So, like, how do you approach expressing a political point of view in your films?
Well, I think, I mean, probably it goes back to that thing about not dividing characters into good and evil. Mm. Because in Walker, for example, apart from Marley Matlin's character, who dies very early on and does seem to be genuinely good, all the characters in Walker are bad. You know, some of them are worse than others, but they are all bad. And that includes the Nicaraguan characters with whom Walker associates. And I think that not to make that division, not to play the story from the perspective of a good American journalist who goes down to Nicaragua and sees the reality of everything, you know, because that was what Salvador was like, and that was what The Year of Living Dangerously was like,
right,
and Under
right.
Fire. You know, these films that got made around about the same time, but they had to be seen through the eyes of an inverted commas good American journalist. There are no good American journalists. They're all deeply corrupt. If they weren't, they wouldn't be. They'd be in jail like Julian Assange was until 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that, because I just watched Walker recently for the first time because it's unfortunately very hard to come by, but it's fantastic. But I was really struck by, you know, maybe not the scenes of outrageous violence, but one that really stuck with and unsettled me is the scene of Walker weeping in his sleep about his dead fiancée, and this moment of this character who we've now seen to be this vicious and unrepentant killer having this moment of deep vulnerability and fear and trembling and sadness in the midst of this like Holocaust that he's doing on this country. And it's a very unsettling moment that I think is kind of what you're getting at with what you're talking about, the not all one way or the other.
Yeah. And very insulting to the lady that he's in bed with.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes.
But that's the thing. I mean, it's not like, I mean, Walker maybe is a little bit of a comic book character, but there is a side to Walker. When Walker starts out, you know, he's anti-slavery, you know, he's very progressive in favor of God, science, and hygiene. But then through his process, in order to maintain power, he abandons every principle that he possessed because the only thing that matters to him is clinging to power and being Walker, 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 you know. And yet within him, as Sy's character points out to him when they read from his diary, you know, he was woke. You know, Walker had this army of black people and Mexicans and Nicaraguans all fighting for justice and freedom. You know, unfortunately, it didn't work out that way.
So Will alluded to it earlier. The device that you use in Walker, that as the film goes on, you slowly introduce more modern props and scene elements, which is, you know, as Will said, a very interesting and clever way of kind of linking this very 19th century story to the current moment in a way that becomes more and more evident as the film goes on. I was just wondering how you came up with that and decided to implement that device. And then also just, if you have any thoughts in general of like putting history on film and making those resonances between the current moment.
I think that that was probably something that Rudy Wurlitzer, who was the screenwriter, pushed very strongly because he didn't want to make a conventional film. He thought, I mean, he'd written Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, you know, and that was a very, very good Western, you know, but it was a, you know, conventional Western too. And I think he wanted to do something that was different. He didn't just want to take another historical trip down memory lane. He wanted to make it relevant to the society in which we were living. And so the anachronisms, I think, was something that he and I and Lorenzo, the producer, we were all behind them because they made sense. And they said that this isn't just, you know, an historical story of things that happened long ago. This is a story that's happening right now, which was much more interesting for us. And also at the time, there were some other films that were doing the same kind of thing. Derek Jarman's film Caravaggio did a very similar thing. There were computers and anachronistic elements in that film. And there was a Russian film called Remembrance about Stalin. And this was still in Soviet times. But it too was kind of genre breaking and incorporated anachronisms to say, you know, Stalin may be dead, but the system that created him is still with us, you know. And so I think that was interesting that that was a movement that was starting, that had shoots, a little shoots there, that a historical film didn't have to pretend to be really happening in the period, that you could play around with contemporary relevance and contemporary issues as well.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about you working with Rudy Wurlitzer. He's one of my favorite writers, I think. And I was wondering how that came to be. What made you choose him? Did you choose him? And like, what made you choose him to write this story?
This is thanks to Harry Dean Stanton.
Wow.
Because when I was in Rotterdam, I think that was the first... Well, the second film festival that I went to, and they were showing Repo Man in Rotterdam, and they'd invited Harry Dean over for the screening as well. And so I walked into the bar of the hotel, something like that, on the way to the screening, and there was Harry sitting at a table with another guy. And so I went over and said, "Hi, Harry, how you doing, man?" And Harry introduced me to the person he was sitting with, and he goes, "And this is Rudy." And I go, "You're Rudy Wurlitzer, author of Two-Lane Blacktop and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid." and he was, you know. And I think that, you know, I was an innocent and I ran up a hotel, I mean, not a hotel, but I ran up a telephone bill at the hotel, you know, calling the States to say the film had been very well received. And I ended up owing them like $100 or something. And Rudy, even though we'd only just met, he loaned me $100. Pay my phone bill for the hotel, which I later paid him back. So so we bonded very early on, and it was a wonderful thing. And of course, I think almost immediately I was thinking, you know, about William Walker and about making a film in Nicaragua. And this is the guy to write it, because the idea of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is that these are two men who are seeking their own death. But the only way they can get there is by climbing up a pile of bodies. And that, of course, is the story of Walker as well. And so even though the two films aren't that similar, but that's at the heart of both of them, I think.
Yeah.
You've mentioned Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. You mentioned Peckinpah. I know like the Italian Western filmmakers are a big influence on you. Hesse, I think you had a question about Western influences on his work.
Yeah. I read somewhere that when you were at UCLA, you wrote a thesis about spaghetti Westerns. And... I was wondering if you could, if you remembered what that thesis was about, and also like who were some of your guys, who are some of your favorite, what are some of your favorite spaghetti Western movies? Like, I know there's a lot of Django Kill in
Straight to Hell.
Yeah, in Straight to Hell. And yeah. One of my favorites, For a Few Dollars More, there's some influences of that in there with like the opening titles. But I was wondering like, yeah, what was your thesis about, and who are some of your guys?
Well, that was funny because I wrote this, because I'd started out at UCLA, I'd got into the critical studies program, because I didn't have a body of work. If you wanted to go into production, you had to be able to show the films that you'd made, and I hadn't really made any films. So I got into critical studies, and I was just trying to work my way through critical studies as quickly as possible so I could switch to production. And so I wrote this thesis about Italian Westerns. But it was very bad. It was because that was a time when there was a lot of semiotics around. You remember Roland Barthes and all that stuff?
Yeah.
And categorizing everything and splitting everything up into little categories and made it all meaningless. And it was kind of in that form. But many years later, I rewrote it, or I did it, or I just did it again. I wrote a book about Italian Westerns called 10,000 Ways to Die, which is now in its second edition, and you can find a copy in the bookshop. And it's a book about, it's a chronological history of the Italian Westerns, because once I got the semiotics out of my system, I realized that the only real way to understand anything or to approach anything is via chronology. Because you can only understand what's going on in Ukraine if you go, well, at least 90 years back in historical time, if not much further. Mm-hmm. And you can only understand what's happening in Gaza if you go back a similar distance or much further. And then you can start, you can see how systems develop and how things come about. And so the book that I finally wrote is a chronological history of the Italian Western from the point of view of a film director. And it's called 10,000 Ways to Die. And in terms of my faves, yeah, I'm the same as you. I love For a Few Dollars More. I think that's probably like the most perfect Italian Western. But I love Once Upon a Time in the West, and I love Django Kill very much. And yes. And also a movie called Requiescant, directed by Carlo Lizzani, in which Pasolini plays a small part.
Oh, wow.
There's some great Italian Westerns.
And you're like, you're talking about the Italian Western. Do you see like a marked contrast between like the Italian directors, their vision of the American West, and the American West that is depicted in like the classic American Westerns? And like, do you see that your role as a filmmaker with it doing a similar kind of, I don't know, demythologizing? Because like the Italian Westerns is like, everyone in the West is like a cold-blooded killer. They are ruthless, gleeful murderers with no moral code or character whatsoever, as opposed
or
to like,
dead.
You know, the But like, yeah, like do you see like a similar like sort of juxtaposition in your work and like how you depict America and like how America depicts itself or how America wants to be depicted?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, I think it depends on which American Westerns we're talking about, because I think that Peckinpah was a person of leftist inclinations. Peckinpah was very angry about the Vietnam War. He used to send telegrams to Nixon. I don't know what Nixon thought getting these telegrams asking him to pull out of Vietnam from Sam Peckinpah, but Peckinpah was incensed about the Vietnam War.
Mr. Nixon, please stop this war. Stop.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you get, and then he made The Wild Bunch, which begins with a bunch of guys in American Army uniforms provoking a massacre of civilians, you know? And so Peckinpah knew what he was doing. And there were other directors of Westerns like Sam Fuller or who was the guy who directed The Gunfighter? Tending in a leftist direction too.
I can't remember.
Oh, it's easy to find out. But anyway,
Henry King.
John Ford. Henry King, of course. Henry King, of course, who also directed The Bravados, another sort of kind of neo-Western. Didn't he direct also Yellow Sky? Very good film. So there was a tendency to make Westerns which were social commentary. But sometimes, think about what John Ford did with Fort Apache. He makes this film in which Henry Fonda's character, this very upright, very by the book colonel in the cavalry, causes all his guys to get killed. And at one point, in order to attempt to prevent the massacre, John Wayne, who plays a sergeant in the film, he throws down his glove in front of Henry Fonda. And nobody notices that when they view the film. That's a challenge to a duel. He is challenging his superior officer to fight it out. And Fonda, because he's a chicken, doesn't do it. Fonda's character. And so the film is very, very critical of the military and very, very critical of the imperial project. And yet, after the story is over, there's an epilogue in which they lie outright about Fonda's character. You know, and there's a glorious montage of the troops all marching through the sky and all that stuff, because the important thing is to print the legend and to recreate the story of Fonda's character as if he were a hero. And so I think that that was quite interesting, because Ford was obviously quite conflicted in terms of what he wanted to say and what he felt he had to say.
I saw an intro you did for your like movie presentation series on BBC Two of the Parallax View, where you talk about your theories about the JFK assassination. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that a little bit, and what you think happened. Who killed JFK? We're going to get to the bottom of it right now.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I mean, there's been so many theories about who was actually pulling the triggers in Dealey Plaza over the years. But I think that the only way that that murder could have been accomplished is with the complicity of the Secret Service.
Yeah.
Because they were the people who pulled the guards off the vehicle. They were the people who all kept well back while the shooting was occurring. Greer, the Secret Service agent driving the car, was the guy who jammed the brakes on when the shooting started. So I think if you're trying to find who was responsible, who were the intellectual authors of the Kennedy assassination, they were able to control the behavior of the Secret Service, and they were able to control the autopsy. Mm-hmm. Because the Secret Service literally stole the body of Kennedy. The autopsy was supposed to take place at Parkland Hospital, but the Secret Service pulled out their guns, stuck Kennedy's bleeding corpse into an improvised coffin, and took it off to Washington, D.C. And the autopsy was supervised by the military. And even down to like there being a couple of generals there, one of them smoking a big cigar throughout the autopsy. So I would assume it was a military coup, as almost happened yesterday in Bolivia. It was a military coup. It was organized at the highest levels by the Joint Chiefs. But it couldn't have been achieved also without the complicity of the intelligence agencies. And it's important to remember that Kennedy had fired Dulles, who was the head of the CIA, and Cabell, who was deputy head of the CIA, was an Air Force intelligence officer whose brother was the mayor of Dallas. And so there was a lot of resentment directed towards Kennedy by these CIA guys who'd lost their jobs, especially Dulles. And Dulles then got himself put by LBJ on the Warren Commission. And of all the Warren commissioners, Dulles was the one who attended the most meetings and who sort of organized the direction of the Warren Commission and the decisions that it made. So I would assume that the assassination had to be done with the complicity of the Secret Service, but it was directed by the U.S. military, and the cover-up was organized by Alan Dulles and the CIA. And I think that's a pretty common belief.
You
know? I think that all tracks. Yeah.
Case closed. Yeah. I mean, it's
case closed, right?
Yeah. Case closed.
No, Costner did it. that's the fallback position, you know.
Yeah.
If the official story is too ridiculous, then Putin did it, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
So before we get on to your newer project, I would like to circle all the way back to your earliest works and just ask you a question about, I guess not as much music, but aesthetic. Your first two major films, Repo Man and Sid and Nancy, are both deal with punk in fairly direct ways. And you also had a working relationship and I assume friendship with several punk musicians. But you also seem to approach the whole scene from a kind of critical angle. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about your relationship to punk at the time, the movement or the aesthetic, and kind of what you felt about it then and what you feel about it now.
Oh, I mean, the aesthetic was great. The music was great. And it was a revolutionary movement. It was like surrealism. Mm-hmm. You know? And remember what Louis Buñuel said about surrealism. You know, we weren't just interested in making films or painting pictures. You know, we wanted to change the nature of society, make everything different. And we completely failed. And just as surrealism failed, punk failed. And there's a scene in Sid and Nancy, there's one scene in Sid and Nancy which tells you what the film is about. And it's the scene where Cy Richardson plays the man in the methadone clinic. And before he gives them their doses of methadone, he makes them listen to a lecture based on McCoy, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, where he says it was the intelligence agencies that were shipping all this heroin out of Vietnam in body bags and injecting it into the arms of young Americans. And you guys, the pair of you, are a disgrace, you know. And that's the point of the film. But it gets lost in the romantic saga of Sid and Nancy.
Well, but before we get you out of here, could you let us know what you're working on nowadays and like what your current project is and how things are going with that, what we can expect from it?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I've been trying to make a sequel to Repo Man for 40 years. I've been able to get the rights to the American rights back. So I now own the American rights to the screenplay sequels and remakes, but not foreign. And unless I could get foreign, that film will never happen. So in the meantime, I'm making a film which probably will be my last movie because I'm nearly 70. And it's based on a book by Gogol called Dead Souls. And it's the story of a man who pays good money for the names of dead people because he's figured out a way to turn those dead people into more money. And it's a great book. It's a very funny book. In a very funny book if you have a certain sense of humor. It's Mel Brooks's favorite book. Mel Brooks still alive, 97 years old, and apparently he has a copy by his bed. and so it's an adaptation that I have done of Gogol's Dead Souls to be shot in Almeria in the south of Spain, where the Italian westerns were made, and also outside Tucson in Arizona, in the Saguaro Desert. And it's the story of the man who collects the names of dead Mexicans and what he does with them. and I'm trying to raise money for it, or I am raising money for it, via a Kickstarter campaign. You know, even though those things are, you know, slightly less common than they used to be. But so far it's gone very well, but I need more money. Give me more money. And so if any of your listeners would care to, if they went to the Kickstarter site, you just type in my last movie or type in my name, and which is Alex Cox, and you'll be directed to the page, and you can, you can do anything from obtain a copy of the score by Dan Wall for $11 to be the executive producer. Oh, many things in between. Thing you can't do now. One of the rewards on the Kickstarter campaign was to have your name on a grave in the cemetery in the film, and that was the most popular by far. But the thing is, we got to 60 graves, and we had to call a halt because the art department have to make these graves,
sure,
you know, and we have to put them in the cemetery and paint people's names on them, and it would be abusive to the art department to go beyond.
It's very, very appropriate for the subject matter for Gogol and Dead Souls and purchasing the names of dead people to make money off of them. So it's perfect.
Here, the live people are paying you to be dead.
Ernesto Cardenal was the priest who was the minister of culture in Nicaragua when we were making Walker, and he wrote various poems about William Walker. And one of them, there was a couplet. Garrison and Morgan knew what they were doing, and down in Nicaragua, they made dollars off the dead. And so that's what we're trying to do now. You know? Goes around, comes around.
It's a call to action for, I was just going to say, it's a call to action for our listeners. Go on Kickstarter now and donate.
We will all be kicking in after this.
Become a dead soul
Thank
for
you,
Alex
guys.
Cox.
Thank you very much. Yes. No, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No, anything we can do to get another Alex Cox movie out there. And before we let you go, I would just have to acknowledge, you know, really the obvious debt that this podcast, Movie Mindset, owes to your movie drome series. But, you know, in light of that, I just wanted to ask you real quickly, what's the last good movie you've seen? This could be in theater, a movie you've seen many times before, just the last good movie you watch that you'd like to share or pass along or evangelize to our listeners.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, No, I watched Once Upon a Time in the West on video again recently, but that's hardly fair to say that. a couple of years ago, I saw a film by Andrei Konchalovsky called Sin. Do you know that film?
I'm not familiar with that. I haven't seen that.
It's an artist biopic, and I won't tell you too much more. It was made in Italy. It's very, very, very good. And he's a Russian director, but it was made with an Italian crew, Italian actors. And it's about one of the greatest artists of all time. But it's not a hagiography. It's actually a very complicated film. And I highly recommend that you try and see Sin by Konchalovsky.
Amazing.
Yeah, sold.
Consider it seen.
Yes.
Good.
And consider the Kickstarter kickstarted. Alex Cox, I really want to thank you so much for joining us. It has been a really privilege to talk to you. And I want to thank you so much for like just your movies and just how much they have informed my life and sensibility and, you know, ongoing interest in movies. So really, thank you. Thank you so much, Alex.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.